what's keeping me from implementing some of these technologies that we know are beneficial? Maybe it's the proper mineral formulation. Maybe it's the right balance of nutrition or supplementing, cows and late lactate, whatever it is, what's keeping me from doing those things? And I think once we identify the frictions, it might be facilities, Travis, as you mentioned. It may be simply time. It may be in lack of whatever those frictions are. We've got to address those in order to help our producers in this area specifically implement some of these management changes and priorities. I always used to kind of, it was a running joke in practice, and I still make it at times. If we were to implement every change or intervention that every resource combines and gives us, we ought to be weaning 900-pound calves and milking an extra 10 pounds a day.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lallemand Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Mullenix. Today, I'm lucky to have Dr. Daniel Cummings with me. Welcome to the show.
Well, Dr. Travis, thank you for having me and looking forward to it. Appreciate the invitation.
So you're a practicing vet located in Madisonville, Tennessee. So kind of give the audience your background. I know, obviously, you went to Auburn by the Auburn sign behind your head. But yeah, give the audience a review of the clinic you work for and how you got in your role you are today.
Thanks, Travis. Yeah, War Eagle. I'll start with that. Proud of my alumni there at Auburn and stay in contact with those folks quite a bit. So yeah, I started out when I graduated from vet school. Went into a mixed animal practice in Middle Tennessee, so Clarksville, east of Crossville, where you were for a time, and enjoyed my time there so much. I got to work for a group of veterinarians that really focused on their clients. I mean, they were very client-centric and learned so much from them. Mentorship was excellent, all of the above. And from there, I decided, I want to carve out a little bit of a path that is more focused on beef cattle. And that was my passion growing up and really where I wanted to focus my time, felt like it was my calling, and kind of took a leap of faith and went out into beef cattle practice as a solo practitioner. Now, at that time, the market wasn't what it is today. We're sitting on some highs. And so there were some challenges and had to work through, but really rewarding and fulfilling experience. Did a short stint, not a short stint, 4-year stint with Boehringer Ingelheim as a professional service veterinarian. And part of the thought there was, I got a lot to learn and still do. It's a continual learning process for me. And so really wanted to understand that side of the industry, the pharmaceutical business, and worked with a great group of colleagues there and can't say enough about their professionalism. And then I joined, went back into practice as a partner with Heritage Vet Partners, which is where I am today, and really focusing on cow-calf and stocker clients in the Southeast is where the majority of my time is focused, along with some other neat projects that we may get into, such as research and innovation and animal health technologies that we're exploring.
Well, that's great. So for any, I know I've got quite a few students, undergrad students that listen to this podcast and a lot of them want to be vets. Any recommendations for these students that may be, in school or looking at vet schools or finishing vet school on what you achieved and accomplished and just any recommendations that you may have for them?
Well, Travis, it's a rigorous journey. And you've got to stay focused. And one word comes to mind to get through the journey and to be fulfilled. And that's grit. You got to have an insurmountable amount of grit. And I think that embodies the beef industry in general. I mean, we are gritty folks. And I think that is important for up and coming veterinarians, aspiring veterinarians. So that's one aspect. The other would be keep an open mind. It's amazing what you can do in the beef industry. And I'll expand that to any professionals in the beef industry, operations managers. I mean, not just veterinarians, but the opportunities are blessings, and they are endless. There's so many things you can go into, and I always encourage well-rounded experience. Think about things. Make yourself uncomfortable at times. It'll squirm you a little bit, but get uncomfortable, and what you'll learn and be rewarded will really be pleasing to you.
No, I like that term of make yourself uncomfortable. We like to be comfortable, and that limits, and so that will always limit us. And so let's get back to the topic at hand and move over to some animal health technologies. And so, you know, as a vet, as a practicing vet, in what ways have animal health technologies provided value to your clientele as cow-calf or stocker operators in Tennessee? I'm sure where you're located, you probably have bigger range than that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, when I think about animal health technologies, oftentimes we you know, our mind goes to value. We think about, okay, what's the value? What's the potential return on investment? And I think it's hard to put dollar figures on all of it. Of course, we can. We conduct research. We are interested in certain nutrition practices, management practices, certain technologies, and the value they bring to our clients. As a practicing veterinarian today, part of my role and my responsibility that I do not take for granted, I take very seriously, is how we're applying these animal health technologies and not just the short-term performance or production gains that we may benefit or prevention of losses. Sometimes we view it as insurance, but also what are some of the delayed long-term effects of using these technologies that I need to be cognizant of and advise my clients on. So I think about it from that standpoint. Some examples that come to mind of really strong returns in particularly cow-calf and I, again, in the feeder stocker segment, our growth implants, for example. I think you can look at those time and time again and see a consistent benefit. Anthelmintics come to mind, albeit, you know, again, I kind of get into the what are some of the unintended consequences of those technologies. But we are blessed and so thankful for the organizations that help provide these technologies and keep us in strong supply when things aren't always easy. And for our producers to use them on their operations and us as veterinarians or animal health professionals, be able to advise on them and understand them better. And we're constantly learning. We are constantly learning. There are new applications. There's new ways to do things. And we've got to keep that mindset that, you know, we don't know everything about every technology and how it affects our systems. But we are trying to learn each and every day.
You know, you touched on something I think is important, that not all technologies provide a economic benefit. Mm-hmm. But they're important technologies from the welfare of the system.
Totally agree.
And I think about preconditioning when that comes up is, you know, that's one thing that, you know, a lot of producers push back on is I don't see economic benefit of preconditioning my calves, but it's a long-term welfare issue to me. And so we're setting those calves up, right? And it's just a system that we have to look at, the long-term welfare of that animal.
The evidence is so strong, Travis, that, you know, preconditioning programs are effective at preventing health challenges down the road. It's 100% a welfare issue. And when we think about common disease manifestations that are very complex in nature, and matter of fact, my colleague, Dr. John Richardson, would argue that bovine respiratory disease is the most complex mammalian disease that we are aware of. And I agree with him in that. But when we think about those diseases and we study those collectively with academicians and private practitioners and others, there are a lot of effects that go into, it's multifaceted, but a preconditioning program, time and time again, will help. I mean, it's not a stop, you know, one-all stop from that standpoint, but it will 100% help. And BRD, is a painful condition. It is a welfare. We need to be mm-hmm. thinking about it from that context. I appreciate you bringing that up. So true.
So speaking of that, how does your colleagues or your clientele perceive these technologies or these management practices?
You know, I think in large, they're perceived very well. And part of the reason is because they've become such commonplace. They've become kind of status quo, if you will, traditionally. We think about You can't go into a producer meeting and make the comment blackleg vaccine. Everyone knows what you're referring to. So they've become very commonplace. They're perceived well. I've got a group of colleagues that I want to mention, and it's the VAST group. It's Veterinary Advancement of Systems Thinking. And we spend quite a bit of time thinking about how these technologies impact, of course, individual animals at times, impact the overall population, the epidemiology of it, if you will. But then in kind of jumping up one more level, how does it impact the system? Are there system-wide impacts that we need to be considering when we apply these technologies, whether it's, you know, medicated feed additives, for example, and maybe impacts on in a year from now, antimicrobial resistance or just different things like that, Travis, that we're thinking about. But in large, they're perceived well because traditionally they've been extremely valuable. And our mindset has shifted a bit to we know they're valuable. We know we need these. We want to preserve their utility now. How do we do that? How do we preserve the utility of these technologies so the next generation has them available and that they're effective for their benefit and the cattle's benefit?
So how, you know, I spent time in Tennessee and there's a lot of cows in Tennessee. There's a lot of stockers in Tennessee, especially north and south of Nashville. But you still got a lot of smaller operators, right? So average is what, 10, 15 head per producer. And so, you know, in that context, how do you work with those smaller producers that it's not about economics because they're not making any money? And so how do you make that, you know, make that connection with them to make those management decisions that are for the best of the animal, but they may not have either the time, they may not have the facilities, et cetera. So how do you work with those producers of adopting stuff?
Travis, that's a great question. We could spend the next decade attempting to answer, because sometimes you have an intervention or you have an idea in mind that you think, boy, this is going to move the needle. And there's a delayed effect. You know, you don't see it moving the needle immediately, but maybe you planted some seeds and 5-10 years from now, it had an impact. I think one way to do it is through education. You know, we've got great resources from all levels. We, you know, extension services, beef quality assurance, et cetera. And I say that education piece, but we have to be consistent in our messaging. We do not want to provide conflicting messages. And I think that confuses. There are so many resources available today. Just pick up Drovers, pick up any magazine, and there's an article about these different things. We have to be consistent in our messaging as to the benefits of these certain management practices and what they mean, or else it's gonna create some confusion. And I think, again, in large part as a beef industry, we've gotten there. So I think it starts with education and proper training. And then we've got to identify the frictions. And you mentioned a couple of them. When I say frictions, what I'm referring to is what's keeping myself. I mean, I'm your example. I've got 25 cows roaming right out back. So I am the producer you're referring to. What's keeping me from implementing some of these technologies that we know are beneficial? Maybe it's the proper mineral formulation. Maybe it's the right balance of nutrition or supplementing, you know, cows and late lactate, whatever it is, what's keeping me from doing those things. And I think once we identify the frictions, it might be facilities, Travis, as you mentioned, it may be simply time. It may be in lack of whatever those frictions are. We've got to address those in order to help our producers in this area specifically implement some of these management changes and priorities. I always used to kind of, it was a running joke in practice, and I still make it at times. If we were to implement every change or intervention that every resource comes by us and gives us, we ought to be weaning 900 pound calves and milking an extra 10 pounds a day. There's only so much we can do, right, as producers. And so we've got to help prioritize. And I think the coveted relationship between the client and the veterinarian is a great way to start. Have a relationship with your veterinarian so you can have these conversations. Great way to start.
It's a tremendous relationship that, you know, even when I was in an extension, you know, we were somewhat jealous of that connection that you had with producers because, you know, you were the front line more than extension at some point. And so we would get a lot of resources back from our veterinary clinics of what's going on, what challenges, et cetera, because they had a very close relationship with a lot of those producers.
Yeah, and I'll mention here too that a lot of veterinarians, myself included, I'll be going to an extension meeting here in about 3 weeks to help facilitate and hope to have an impact. It's important for our practitioners that have those relationships to also plug in with local extension. Again, it goes back to consistent and aligning in our messaging. And we call that in systems thinking, we call that creating shared vision. We have to, and I think sometimes if we're to honestly reflect, and I don't mean this about extension and veterinarians, but just in general as the beef industry, we may not always have shared vision. And until we create shared vision and we know where we want to go, it's going to be difficult to achieve some of the things we're discussing.
Well, it goes back to, you touched on it, is the system. And so, we work in a big system. It's very complex.
Very much so.
And it's not nutrition. It's not animal health. It's all aspects of the system from conception to slaughter. And that's an extremely complex system.
Agreed. And they're all interconnected. They're all interconnected.
So are there any concerns about the sustainability of use of some of these technologies for beef producers?
I think so. And I don't want it to be a fear message at all. But I think we need to be aware of, again, what are some of the unintended consequences that could present when we're applying these technologies in our systems. Ones that come to mind in particular is antimicrobial resistance. That's a One Health concern. And One Health meaning, I'll define that as environmental health, human health, animal health. They're, again, connected system. We need to be aware of it as practitioners. And so how we use antimicrobials and judicious use of antimicrobials can certainly lead to some unintended consequences that down the road we may not be able to we're kind of maybe writing checks we can't cash, so to speak, and we need to be aware of those. I think another one that comes to mind is anthelmintics or dewormers, and particularly in some of the systems that I find myself embedded in, and those are intensive grazing, permanent pasture systems. We are high stocking rates, 2 calves per acre, maybe a cow calf pair per acre, whatever, high stocking rates, because we've got forages that grow due to the rainfall. It's part of the system. We get 45 plus inches of rain annually and can make grass grow. That's excellent. But one of the things that does when we place those animals in a really dense or confined area is we potentially exacerbate the effects of parasites, of worms in those populations. And of course, the way we've controlled them is through anthelmintics, so, or dewormers. So over time, you could see where we could get some issues there. And it's unfortunate when we run into those situations, and they are real and they're happening every day. So I'm not positioning against those products. What I'm trying to understand is what levers can I pull to ensure they're effective long-term and maybe reduce the risk.
Now, I also think about, along with dewormers in that conversation, is fly control.
Oh, certainly.
And so many times we get stuck on a certain product or active ingredient, I guess, in that case, but that we're using the same products year in, year out. And we have seen in a lot of environments a change in our fly population, a change in timing of our fly population, and we may not have the best technologies right now that as we need to help deal with some of those changes.
I certainly agree. And I feel like sometimes I'm a prisoner to the system, because what I'm doing is just recommending a different product and a different product and a different product. And you go to the shelf and lo and behold, man, I've tried all these products. I know our listeners can relate to that. Man, I've tried all this to control flies. I've tried all this to control pink eye or again, name whatever the challenge is. And now the shelf is empty. So we again, it goes back to the system and management practices. Animal husbandry, can't say enough. So important when we think about all those things, Travis. Certainly agree.
Yeah. So I know for a lot of producers, it's very frustrating, especially of understanding that. And so understanding that I can't use the same product, or understanding of I got to rotate stuff, or I got to buy something new. And so that's where some of that system thinking and working with extension and getting that out of helping producers making those wise choices instead of using the same thing year in, year out.
Right. I'll give you an example of that I think we the listeners and our producers can certainly relate to. So we've got different formulations of dewormers, and again, blessed to have them. Some are a little bit more general than others, and as far as their effects, they control external parasites, and I'm referring to the porons. Well, we think we may be rotating porons or from a poron to an injectable, but if you actually look at the ingredient, it's the same. It's the exact, we think, man, I thought I rotated. I thought I did what I was, but no, it's the same ingredient, because some of the products come as an injectable formulation and as a poron formulation. So that's a prime example, Travis, of what you're referring to.
Yeah. The product name may change sometimes, but the active ingredient is the same. And so we have to be very careful of rotating active ingredients and not products.
Correct. Yep. If that's a tactic that your veterinarian or your whoever you're working with recommends, you've got to be very careful. Couldn't agree more. Yeah.
So in terms of controlling parasites and internal parasites, you know, how do you think about preserving utility of those dewormers, et cetera, in the future?
Yeah, so we're getting, you know, specifically with internal parasites, and just to refresh, there are many internal parasite species that can cause infection and then subsequent performance loss in our growing animals, in our growing calves. So I think about those a lot. How can we mitigate those effects? There's the economic analysis will show, and lots of research demonstrates a return on investment. So I'm coming from the mindset, and my mental model today has changed that. How do I preserve that? How do I get that bang for my buck and not have the unintended consequence of resistance to build up? So there's a few tactics to consider. One is always try to dose by the accurate weight of the animal. You know, those are the logistics items that are important. Make sure we give it the right route of administration. If it calls for subcutaneous or under the skin, making sure we're hitting those spots and doing all those things correctly. And oftentimes we skip that step and it kind of goes without saying. Critically important. And then the next phase is having a conversation with your veterinarian or professionals in your area, resources, about some more advanced methods to preserve the utility. And what I'm referring to are refusion. It's a word that I think some are probably familiar with, but can be a little bit misunderstood. And it's the parasites that are either in the environment or in the animal that we're leaving in refuge, if you will, from the drug. So we're not exposing them to the drug itself, to the dewormer. Different ways to accomplish that. But what that does is it leaves you with a susceptible gene pool. So when you have parasites that aren't exposed to your drug and there's not a selection pressure factor there, then they can pass susceptible genes on to the next generation. So great way. Parasitologists, major recommendation. If you've got any small ruminant folks listening, they'll be familiar with it in terms of FAMACHA, for example. Great strategy there. I've not been able to convince any of my clients to look at the conjunctiva color or whatnot and make a decision based on this. So it is challenging. There's some implementation factors we got to consider. The second that comes along with refugia that you'll hear commonly is what we refer to as combination treatment. So in other words, maybe using in the animals that you do treat with dewormers, maybe using a couple of different active ingredients. The purpose is to achieve the highest efficacy possible because we want to, in the animals we're going to treat, we want to try to kill as many parasites as we can because dead bugs don't shed eggs. I mean, we know that dead parasites are, that's a good thing when the animals we treat. So that's one. And then the second part of that is we return to kind of this broad spectrum efficacy. You know, I'm always reminded when these products were first launched in the marketplace, but they call them pivotal studies or kind of the phase, you know, phase three, phase four studies, whatnot. When they were launched, they were 99%+ effective. And there's ways we can measure if they're effective or not. They were 99%+. We don't see that as commonly in the field today. I mean, we're seeing some that are under 50% effective at different times. And so we need to be aware of that and try to return to that good broad spectrum, achieve that high efficacy. Those two tactics, when used together and implemented appropriately, refugia and combination treatment, have been shown to delay resistance, the onset for many years. The good news about using those is I still have a significant portion of my herd that I am treating and I get the benefit of the dewormer, yet I don't see the resistance build up and I preserve the utility. That's the way I kind of consider it, but lots of things that go into that, lots of different decisions.
So you touched on, you know, Tennessee and Southeast is high intensive, right? You know, one cow per 1-2 acres. And you also are a more humid climate, a lot of rain. Your winters are more temperate. So how do you deal with timing issues? And it's not like, you know, out here we have winter weather, we have cold, we go through a longer period of really cold temperatures. You know, we don't have these intensive grazing systems being in arid environments. So what does that play a role in those producers that deal with more intensive and lack of, you know, maybe not always a lack of, but more tempered environment?
Well, you hit it there, Travis. In our environment, we oftentimes don't see a period where parasites are unable to transmit. I mean, the reproduction is, we had one hard freeze this year, and today it's 71 degrees, and there's moisture in the grass. So I have to imagine those little larvae are having a party out there and ready to transmit. So it absolutely has an impact. And we oftentimes try to divide it into, you know, southern climates that are a bit more temperate, a bit more humid, and how that impacts it in northern climates. And there's great addition in Vet Clinics North America just a few years ago around this topic, and some really good articles Dr. Christine Navarre provided, and for considerations of timing and different things in southern environment. One thing I'll point out, and when considering timing, is that when you decide to treat your animals, particularly if you treat the entire herd, be very cognizant of timing, because if you treat the entire herd and turn them out into an environment that is not conducive for transmission, or in other words, is a really low refugia environment, you can actually exacerbate resistance. You can actually, it can proliferate, versus the opposite from a timing perspective. You know, a recommendation I've heard many times is treat your cattle with your dewormers in the hot, dry summer. That way, you know, you've got it tackled, you clean your animals out. Well, when you do that, the only animals that might be in the environment are resistant animals, or resistant parasites, excuse me. And the other thing I would say is these parasites have evolved in a way that they can survive in these environments for a long period of time, 6 months perhaps, or longer. So we got to be aware of all those factors when we think about timing. There's not, it's a big, it depends. That's my favorite answer. It depends. And so there's not one set time to consider deworming a group of animals.
Yep, it's the ultimate extension response is it depends.
It does. And I know that gets frustrating too, because I hate to hear it as well. Yeah. But it does depend on all the factors we've mentioned.
And well, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but just to wrap us up, anything that we missed that you want to touch on?
You know, Travis, I don't think so. I think we've covered a lot of ground here in a short period of time. And I just want to emphasize again the importance of utilizing the resources you have available locally, because they understand the things we're talking about, whether it's your extension personnel or veterinarians. Just because we said it here doesn't make it the gospel. We need to trust our local resources. They have the expertise, and I encourage you to interact with them and ask questions.
No, that's a great ending to this is, you know, your local resources are, you know, they know what's going on, not only around you, but a lot of your producers, what they're using, what's working. You know, and that's so beneficial of using those resources that are in there, that are helping other producers that know what's going on around you. And so instead of us that I have no clue what's going on in Tennessee.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I told you, the weather today is great if you want to make a trip. We're sunshine and 70 degrees. So
it sounds a lot better than here.
It's time for our famous three.
Is stress affecting your bottom line? Even routine handling, inclement weather, weaning, and dietary changes can significantly lower the rumen pH, causing cortisol levels to spike. Cortisol not only compromises the immune system, but also suppresses normal appetite and feed consumption. The solution? Cattle Active. Increase production and reduce the impacts of stress on your cattle for cents a day. Cattle Active restores the balance naturally. Want to learn more how a feeding program, including Cattle Active, can improve both profits and herd health? Visit us today at proearthanimalhealth.com. Be proactive with Cattle Active.
Three last questions, and we'll end this. But the first one is, what is your recommended go-to beef resource? Website, a book?
Well, as a veterinarian, and I just happen to be reading this one, as a veterinarian, we kind of stick to Vet Clinics in North America. This was the November edition that Dustin Loy and some others were on, is Genomics. It's an unbelievable resource. So Vet Clinics North America.
Yep. Dustin Loy is a great resource for producers and is doing some great stuff with Pink Eye, but that's a great resource as well. Secondly, what is a non-ag book that you highly recommend someone reading?
Well, it's hard to choose one, but I'll go with the most recent one I've been reading on, and that's called Anxious for Nothing by Max Licato. And so, you know, there are so many things that happen in our world today, and even in our industry. Oh, there's drought. Well, it's bad weather. This and of course we can get anxious about it, and that's a natural response. And this book, Anxious for Nothing, has help me realize in the big picture what's happening and that it's all going to be okay. So for me today, Anxious for Nothing by Max Licato would be my recommendation.
No, that sounds like a great resource. Lastly, what sets apart a successful beef professional from someone that isn't?
I'll go back to a word I referenced earlier, and I think I see it time and time again, and that is grit. Just the willingness to push through regardless of the obstacles and have the end in sight. I mean, I always tell my kids that the results are one thing, but the path to get there, the grit, the journey, the work you put in, that's what really matters, and that's what really has an impact. And I think grit is what I would use to sum up the successful professionals in the beef industry that I know.
No, that's a great response. Again, Dr. Cummings, thanks for jumping on, and I really appreciate your insights and a great benefit for a lot of producers.
Again, thanks for having me.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.